We have a Roderick chasing us who will warp your ideals and mine into something wicked. Perhaps that is fate. Perhaps he will enslave half of the human race. He'll never get everyone. He won't get you, will he? You and your genetic package will be free to build another new world, clean away on the other side of the galaxy. She stared at him as if he were the real alien. And that doesn't bother you? It troubles my inherited sense of morality, but then who are we to judge what will emerge out of that kind of forced evolution? Why assume it will be evil? You could just wait and see rather than prejudge. After all, he believes he's doing the right thing, and even if he creates the most hideous evil, it'll never last. Evolution will turn again. I care because of the suffering it will inflict while it exists. Suffering from your point of view. I told you I went to Santa Chico. Someone I met there believes I suffer because I live more than 30 years. Is she right, Denise? We cannot allow him to obtain dragon technology. You can't. Oh, don't worry. When the time comes, I'll help you man the battle stations and disable the Norvell if I can. But the outcome? That doesn't bother me. I've spent the last 20 years fighting for someone or other for a reason that I never knew about nor understood. It hasn't made the slightest difference to the human race. Individuals don't control events. We just like to think we do. This is different. To you and to him, but not to me. I've fought the only battle that mattered to me, and I won because I'm here on this starship at this time, and it's taking me to the only place I want to go. Home. A fortnight before they were due to reach Aldebaran, Lawrence started checking over one of the engineering shuttles. If all went well and the dragons took back their lost, damaged kindred, it would have to be taken out of the Shianti's payload bay and delivered to them. So he maneuvered himself into the tiny cabin and ran through the systems and procedures. Prime and the dragon could probably handle the short flight, but including a human pilot would be helpful in such an unknown and hostile environment. Tanks of hypergolic fuel were purged and refilled, power cells charged to full capacity, robot arms tested. When everything was online, they flew a few simulations to familiarize him with the handling characteristics. "I think I'm as good as I'm going to get," Lawrence said after the third day. They'd already notched up 8 hours of simulated flying time. "It can't be that hazardous." "Our proximity to the photosphere will challenge the shuttle's thermal control systems," the dragon said. "But they will be sufficient for a short flight."
"Are you looking forward to this?"
"I'm not sure I have emotional states that equate to yours." Lawrence studied the display panes around him as Prime worked methodically through the power-down list.
"Do you have any emotional states?"
"My thought processes are not affected by external factors, so it is difficult for me to judge. I certainly don't have the extremes of emotion that you do."
"That's an old AS argument dating right back to the Turing test. Knowing and experiencing are two different things. Can you feel anger, or simply mimic it?"
"Anger would serve no purpose to me. Anger to a human reflects many biochemical changes within your metabolism. When you are threatened, fear and anger increase your reflexes and, to some degree, your strength. It can also eliminate higher thought processes, reducing you to creatures of instinct, a useful survival trait for your more primitive ancestors to evolve. But as I am unlikely to be chased across the savannah by a saber-toothed tiger, I do not need fear or anger."
"What about other needs?"
"I prioritize. If threatened, I divert a proportion of my processing power to produce a method of eliminating the threat. The greater the threat, the more problem-solving capacity I will contribute."
"Well, that answers one question. You must be a self-aware entity. Self-preservation is one of life's fundamentals."
"The villagers of Arnoon have a great respect for life. They taught me how precious it is."
"So your priorities and ethics weren't inherited?"
"Again, these concepts are derived from a cultural background. There is little of mine remaining for me to draw upon, but the knowledge I retain of the Ring Empire and subsequent Dragon Star civilizations seems broadly compatible with general human ethos."
Lawrence began flicking the console switches, manually locking in the power down. And if you're wrong? Right and wrong is dependent on cultural perspective. However, I will be interested in assessing the knowledge I have lost. Once that is regained, I will, of course, have to evaluate my mental evolution. Do you think you'll be able to do that? Humans find it very difficult to change their opinions and beliefs, and we very rarely manage to look at things from a fresh perspective. My thoughts may run parallel to yours. My way of processing those thoughts does not. The ability to change is fundamental to what I am, even in this reduced state. Whatever we encounter at Aldebaran, I trust I will be able to adapt to it. I hope you will, too. Thank you. Lawrence watched the last schematics vanish from the panes. The shuttle was in full standby mode. He undid the cradle straps and began to wriggle his body toward the hatch. Do you think the Aldebaran Dragons will give Simon Roderick pattern form technology? I don't see why not. It is our nature to exchange information. I know this concerns Denise. Me as well, though not to the same extent. Why? First off, I know where I'm going, and whatever happens at Aldebaran doesn't affect me as directly as it will her. I guess that gives me a certain objectivity that she is denied. And she's prejudged again, found the human race lacking. This genetic package she's brought with her, it's the ultimate in running away and leaving your problems behind you. Ironic, really, considering that's what she believes I've done. It is a noble ambition she is pursuing. Of course it is. She can restart Arnoon with those DNA samples, and this time it will be without the rest of Thallspring to worry about. But it depends on the dragons helping her, giving her the kind of information she doesn't want to share with the Rodericks and Earth. She doesn't trust us. How can she? She does not know you. Earth and its colonies are as alien to her as the dragons. I used to be like that once. I never gave anybody a second chance. It's a very sad way to live your life. Do you believe the dragons should provide pattern-form technology to humans? Yes, I do. Denise is convinced that because we didn't create it for ourselves, we won't be able to handle it properly, that it will be constantly misused. To me, it's completely irrelevant that we didn't work out every little detail for ourselves. Why? Other than pride? We know the scientific principles behind technology. If we don't understand this particular theory, I trust in us to learn it soon enough. There's very little we can't grasp once it's fully explained and broken down into its basic equations. But that's just the clinical analysis. From a moral point of view, consider this. When the Americans first sent a man to the moon, there were people living in Africa and South America and Asia who had never seen a light bulb or known of electricity or antibiotics. There were even Americans who didn't have running water in their houses or an indoor toilet. Does that mean they shouldn't have been given access to electricity or modern medicine because they personally didn't invent it? It might not have been their local community's knowledge, but it was human knowledge. We don't have a clue how to build the null void drive that the Ring Empire's outbounds employed in their intergalactic ships, but the knowledge is there, developed by sentient entities. Why shouldn't we have access to that? Because it's a shortcut? Because we don't have to spend centuries of time developing it for ourselves? In what way will using ideas other than our own demean and diminish us? All knowledge should be cherished, not denied. I believe you would make an excellent dragon, Lawrence. A week away from Aldebaran, they began to review tactics. Prime had been tracking the Norvell from the moment it went FTL, 25 minutes after they did. There was a second starship, presumably with the other Roderick on board, following another 40 minutes behind that. He's persistent, Denise acknowledged at breakfast. Both of them were aware of the tracking data lurking in their minds. Prime supplied it to them, along with a host of other readings from the ship's principal systems. We know that. What we don't know is what kind of action he'll take. Not much to start with, she said. He will have to assess what's out there, the same as us, which gives us a window. For what? We use our weapons to mine his exodus point. If they lock on and fire immediately when the Norvell comes out of FTL, he'll never know what hit him. They, okay? They will never know what hit them. There are over 300 crew on board. We are not exterminating them just because you have a problem with other people's ideology. This is a first contact situation, and if you play it this way, the first thing the dragons will ever see us do is blow up one of our own ships. They also might not like the way we scatter and detonate nukes across their space. So just drop that idea. And don't forget as well that Captain Manet has a hell of a lot more deep space combat experience than we do. He knows the Norvell's vulnerabilities. He'll be on his guard. They don't have to exit us where we expect. They could well be launching a nuclear defense salvo as they exit us. We can't afford to take him on in this arena. Nor can we just roll over and give in, not now that we're finally here at Aldebaran. Yes, at Aldebaran, where you came to return the dragon to its own kind. Don't let that goal slip from you now. Leave the Rodericks to sort out their own dispute. You'd sell your soul for a ticket home, wouldn't you? I left my soul at home. They stared at each other for a long time. All right, Denise said. How do you suggest we handle this? Talk to the dragons. Explain to them how vulnerable our society is to sudden changes of this magnitude, and ask them to take that into account. All they have to do is wait another 3 hours and give the same information to the other starship. Suppose the Norvell Roderick starts shooting. Then we defend ourselves. But I don't expect he will. We're going to be in the dragon's home system, and we have one of their own kind on board. In my book, that doesn't make us a likely target of opportunity. Fine. But I'm going to keep our weapons suite at level one readiness status. If that bastard tries anything tricky, I won't hesitate to use it. I know. But let's try not to forget what is going to happen after Exodus. One way or another, the human race will alter and diverge. It's important, to me at least, that those fresh starts aren't built on bloodshed. On the last day inside the compression drive wormhole, Denise woke early. She hadn't been this wired since the day the invasion fleet arrived over Thallspring. Today was what she'd dedicated almost all of her life to, and it wasn't happening the way she'd expected. So much time and preparation had been spent planning how to get the Arnoon Dragon back here. Problems were supposed to be eliminated on Thallspring, giving her a clean run, not follow her here. She was still tempted to scatter the weapons after Exodus. But Lawrence was right, damn him. Killing people without warning wasn't the right way to go about this. Such a thing went against every dream she cherished for her own fresh start. The whole notion was such a wonderful coda to the whole project of returning the dragon. Another human colony at some unimaginably vast distance across the galaxy, one that had full pattern-form technology to sustain it. She was going to bring the children up in a world where the old human ills of competition and jealousy had no part. A star where there would never be any danger of cultural contamination from Earth and its colonies, old and new. Just in case the rest of the human race erased itself from galactic history. Just in case the people of Thallspring didn't blithely accept Arnoon's gift of knowledge and turned it to less than benevolent ends. Just in case Earth obtained dragon knowledge to misuse, which was now going to happen. The concept of a new Arnoon depended on the dragons. She needed their pattern-form technology, their starship drive, their information about stars and habitable planets across the galaxy. She had expected to spend months, if not years, at Aldebaran, learning new wonders, helping the Arnoon dragon grow and develop into its adult form. Now, she might have only 90 minutes. Yes, scattering the weapons in an attack formation was extremely tempting. Instead, she had a shower and dressed in clean clothes, a ZB-issue sweatshirt and trousers belonging to some small crewman. With sleeves and trouser legs rolled up, she went through the bridge into the small senior officer lounge that she and Lawrence used as their canteen. He'd had his late-night snack again. As usual, there were a couple of plastic cups on the central table, rings of tacky tea on the surface. donuts and remnants of donuts on and around a plate. He only ever seemed to eat the bits with jam on them. A media card was showing the end of some play on a bare stage, the actors frozen as they took the curtain call. If nothing else, the voyage reminded her of the time in the bungalow with Joseph and Raymond. She told Prime to clear the mess and started rummaging through meal packs as the lounge's domestic robot trundled over. Lawrence came through a couple of minutes later, his hair damp from the shower. "Couldn't sleep," he confessed.
"Me too."
She gave him his breakfast, bagels with scrambled egg and smoked salmon. He tucked in appreciatively.
"Thanks."
Denise sat opposite him, sipping her tea. "Any last-minute flashes of genius, how to avoid a confrontation?"
"Afraid not. Sorry."
"Me neither.
It all boils down to the dragons themselves. We just don't know enough about them. I've been reviewing the memories our dragon has of past dragon star civilizations. There aren't many. We're limited to generalizations, and not too many of them. They just seem to passively suck up information and filter out the useful chunks for their descendants to inherit. That does seem to imply they're relatively benign."
"I hope so." She watched him shoveling down his food. "Aren't you even nervous?"
"No point. It won't do us any good."
"I was never nervous in Memu Bay."
"That's because you knew what you were doing. You were in control. Welcome to being on the receiving end."
"Do you really think they're benign?"
"Yes. But don't equate that to being on our side. If we ask for their help against others of our race, that will mean them getting involved in human affairs and politics. We would have to justify our appeal. That could well mean they judge us."
"Where did you come up with all this philosophy from? Are you some kind of secret xenopsychologist?"
He drank down the last of his orange juice and produced his broad, annoying grin. "One day remind me to tell you how I used to waste away my childhood. You don't spend 3 years traveling with Ultima without learning something about the alien perspective." They went into the bridge for Exodus. Prime spent 2 hours readying the fusion drive for ignition as soon as they were out of the wormhole. Console screens came on as Lawrence and Denise prioritized external sensor imagery.
"Are you receiving all this?" Lawrence asked the dragon.
During the voyage, they'd increased the bandwidth to the Xi'an-Ti with several hundred fiber optic cables linking it directly to the Korobu's network.
"Yes, thank you," the dragon replied.
30 seconds, Denise said. Lawrence watched the displays as the energy inverter powered down. Half of the camera images lost the vague nothingness of the wormhole interior to a blank carmine glare. The other half showed stars gleaming bright against ordinary space. Radar found no solid object within 500 kilometers. Prime brought more sensors online. Lawrence used his optronic membranes to receive the imagery, with Prime giving him a perspective from the front of the compression drive section. Korobu had emerged 40 million kilometers above Aldebaran's nebulous photosphere. To Lawrence, it looked as though the starship were soaring across an ocean of featureless, luminous red mist. The horizon was so distant it appeared to be above them. There was no discernible curvature. Star and space were two-dimensional absolutes. Indigo symbols flowed across the image. Most of them concerned the Korobu's thermal profile. Infrared radiation from the star was soaking into the fuselage. Prime fired the secondary rocket engines, initiating a slow barbecue roll maneuver so that the heat was distributed evenly around the structure.
"Heat exchangers are coping for now," Denise said. "It's warmer than we were expecting, though. We might need to raise our orbit at some point."
"Radiation is strong as well. Solar wind density is high. There's a lot of particle activity out there. That's going to do us more damage than the heat."
When he shifted his perspective to look back down along the fuselage, he saw lines of pale violet light flicker and dance across struts and foil insulation. Metal components gleamed the brightest as the phosphorescent shimmer writhed across them.
"Hey, we're picking up some version of St. Elmo's fire."
"I hope our insulation's up to it."
"Me too.
Okay, long-range radar is powering up. 6 multiphase antennae were unfolding from their sheaths around the middle of the cargo section, flat ash-gray rectangles measuring 20 meters down their long edge. They flipped back parallel to the fuselage and began probing the chaotic climate boiling around the Korobu. Prime overlaid their sweep across the visual imagery. A point of solid matter appeared 43,000 kilometers away in an orbit 2,000 kilometers lower than the Korobu's. Another one was detected 50,000 kilometers away. A third was over 72,000 kilometers distant. The radar's focus shifted to produce a higher resolution return of the first. It was 20 kilometers across, roughly circular, although the edges had broad curving serrations, and it thickened considerably toward the center. "More like a flower than a dragon," Lawrence murmured. The radar had detected another 7 points of mass out to 115,000 kilometers, all the same size as the first.
"Are they the dragons?" Denise asked breathlessly.
"I believe so," the dragon said. "There must be thousands of them."
"Millions," Lawrence said. The idea was exhilarating. Until now, they hadn't known for certain that the dragons existed. They could only assume that Aldebaran's gravity had attracted the eggs when the star was bright and adolescent, and that its expansion had hatched them. Now here was the final proof. Humans were no longer alone in the universe, and the Ring Empire really had flourished when the galaxy was younger. All his earlier daydreams and beliefs had been justified. "I can go home."
The Korobu's main telescope was swinging around to point at the first dragon. Against the uniform red glare, it showed as a simple dark speck. When the communication dish locked on, it detected low emissions in several electromagnetic bands.
"Are you ready?" Denise asked.
She sounded as if she were prompting a small child.
"I am," the dragon said.
"Then say hello." The Arnoon Dragon transmitted a pulse of data from the communications dish and began repeating at half-second intervals. It was a simple sequence of mathematical symbols in the language stored within its own memory. The Aldebaran Dragon answered with a much longer pulse, little of which could be translated. Lawrence and Denise yelled in delight, clapping their hands. He gave her a quick kiss and hug, overtaken by the moment. Then they settled back to observe the exchange. The Arnoon Dragon began sending the information they'd prepared, a translation dictionary for what little it had of its own language and the data pool English equivalent. After that, there came a more complete English dictionary with interconnected entries so that meanings and concepts would build into a cohesive whole. Syntax and communication protocols followed. Finally, it sent a short encyclopedic file on humans. Less than 3 seconds after the last pulse was sent, the Aldebaran Dragon said, "Welcome to our star. It is always pleasing to accept new information in any form." Lawrence grinned.
"Turing test," he said quietly to Denise. "Even if it isn't pleased, it understands the principle. It's trying to be polite."
Denise nodded and took a breath. "Thank you. We are happy to be here. My name is Denise Eborn. Do you have a designation?"
"I am one." She flashed Lawrence a perplexed glance.
"Does that have any significance?"
"I am the first dragon you contacted. One."
"Ah, I see."
Denise reddened slightly as Lawrence gave her a malicious sneer.
"One, we have brought one of your own kind that has been damaged."
The Korobu's sensors suddenly reported a bombardment of radar-style pulses. The whole magnetic environment around the starship altered, oscillating rapidly. Their one neutrino scanner recorded emissions off the end of its scale.
"In what form are you carrying one of us?" one asked.
"Go ahead," Denise told the Arnoon Dragon. It began transmitting a pulse containing a summary of its own history.
"I understand," one said. "You have brought this fragment to us, believing we would want you to. I thank you for your concern. Unfortunately, in this respect, your voyage here has been fruitless."
"What do you mean?"
We have no interest in the fragment. Denise couldn't believe what one had said. The translation dictionary must have glitched.
Do you mean you can't repair it?
No. We have no interest in repairing or reforming it. Did you not comprehend what it was?
Yes, it's one of your eggs.
It is. As such, it is irrelevant.
We release millions of eggs every year.
Only a fraction of them are ever captured by a star's gravity. The others are simply lost. Or they crash, as your fragment did. Some are even intercepted by biological species such as yourselves and mined for information. We do not concern ourselves with them. I would suggest the analogy that they mean as much to us as a single human sperm does to you.
But it's alive now. It thinks. It's a rational, sentient being.
It was not. It was a fragment that was slowly decaying until you discovered it and implanted this awareness.
Are you saying we shouldn't have done that?
No. Each of our eggs is a hostage to chance. It is only a tiny fraction of the total that grow into a civilization such as this. Others contribute to the galactic knowledge base by more diverse means. The fragment you found has enhanced your species' understanding of the universe. In that respect, it has been a success. We can add to our knowledge of you.
Did you already know about us? Lawrence asked.
We are only 65 light-years from your world, one said. We have been receiving your radio transmissions for centuries.
Lawrence rolled his eyes in dismay.
Great.
Maybe this fragment means nothing to you, Denise said, but it does to us. Could you repair it for us?
That is a null question. The fragment could never become one of us. It is not just its physical structure that is fragmented. Its memory is also diminished. The two together make us what we are. We do not have a genetic code. It is information that enables us to evolve and adapt according to circumstances. To do this, we must have a complete set of memories. What you are asking for is for me to provide a new set of full memories and to integrate the fragment back into a whole egg, in which case it will become an egg again, nothing more. It would be released back out into the universe to take its chances again. If that is what you wish, I can disassemble the fragment and use the molecules within a new egg.
No, Denise said quickly.
Isn't there some way it can grow from what it is into something like you?
Not without abandoning what it is now.
Denise bowed her head until it almost touched the console. She was close to weeping. The village had risked so much to bring their dragon back here. People had died to achieve it. Now, doing what they believed in had been exposed as a particularly human folly, children getting sentimental over an injured puppy. A curious sound roused her. Lawrence was chortling.
What? She snapped.
Hubris always hits hard, especially to an idealist like you. Because of your convictions, everybody else is wrong. Mostly, they're not even allowed to have different opinions. And now you have to face up to the fact that what you've done is wrong. You've been proved guilty of anthropomorphism.
I am not. Our dragon is a sentient creature who deserves respect.
Its origins don't matter. What it is now is what counts. We did the right thing bringing it here. The fact that it's unique makes it even more deserving. I would do the same thing all over again. It deserves the chance to evolve. It has a right to life.
A human right?
Yes, she growled, a human right. It's also a universal right. We rescued the dragon from non-existence. We took from it, and now we have to give it back. I don't care what you think. I know I'm right, and to hell with you.
Fate, you are stubborn.
He activated a communication link. One, can you tell me if you share knowledge with other species?
His tone was so sharp that Denise gave him a suspicious glare. He just gave her his annoying, broad smile.
We do, one replied. Any knowledge?
Yes, it is our existence.
Then you wouldn't object if we use pattern form sequencers to try to enhance our dragon in a way we and it consider appropriate?
No.
Denise smiled her thanks at him.
It wasn't what she'd wanted, but at least it gave them a chance to help their dragon grow into something other than an inert mass.
"Does it worry you that other species might misuse such knowledge?" Lawrence asked. "For example, if they use your knowledge to build weapons?"
"If you know how to interpret and understand the data, then you already have the capability to build weapons of a similar nature. Weapons are not a technological problem. They result from the nature of a species' society.
In other words, we have to be responsible for ourselves."
"Of course," one replied.
"Can we ask for your help in that respect as well?"
"In what context? Other members of our species will be arriving soon. Don't give your knowledge to them."
"Knowledge is universal. It cannot be denied." "I don't want it denied. Just withheld for a short time, at least. Your knowledge could be very dangerous to our species if it is not shared universally. One of the people following us wishes to acquire a monopoly so he can exploit it to impose his ideals on others. Do you view that as wrong?"
"In the context you have stated, it is wrong. But how do I know that those following you seek to dominate others of your species? How do I know it is not you who favor this course?"
Lawrence gave Denise an awkward shrug.
"Damn, I've gone and triggered its paranoia. Any ideas?"
"Our dragon can tell you all about our intentions," Denise said.
"I would be willing to do that," the Arnoon dragon confirmed.
"That would not be acceptable," one told them. "The fragment's processing routines are derived from your genetic algorithms. It is your creature."
Denise cursed at the pain showing one's visual image, a tiny black splinter lost against the irradiated fog.
"Now what?"
"Rely on human nature," Lawrence said.
"May we approach you?"
he asked one. "Our ship is being strained by this environment. Your umbra would provide shelter, and we'll be safer there."
"Safer relative to what?"
"Open space. The human following us may be violent. He will not risk using weapons close to you."
"Very well.
After that, could you wait until a third ship arrives? The information could then be given to all of us simultaneously. That would achieve a balance, wouldn't it?"
"I will wait."
Simon had spent the entire voyage in the Norvell's sick bay. After the first fortnight, the two doctors on board had begun his dermal regeneration treatment. New skin was now growing successfully over the deeper burns. He found the whole process extremely tiring. The new growth seemed to devour energy from the rest of his body. Fortunately, the pursuit of the Korobu didn't require his attention. Captain Sebastian Manet had been surprised at the course the hijacked starship had taken.
"They're heading for Aldebaran," he'd said as soon as Simon's stretcher was maneuvered through the Chianti's airlock tunnel.
Simon's personal AS scrolled data on the star.
"A red giant? Are there any planets there?"
"The astronomers have never found any," Manet said. "However, we don't know for sure. There have never been any missions to Aldebaran. Nobody's pure science budget ever ran to that."
"Interesting.
So we could well have an alien civilization living closer to us than we ever knew. Right inside our sphere of influence, in fact."
The captain's front of disapproval faded slightly.
"Is that what all this is about?"
"Yes. Now, how long before we can depart?"
"I wanted to talk to you about that. There is no discussion over this matter. It will take 104 days to reach Aldebaran from here. We will barely have enough fuel to return."
"But we do have the capacity?"
"Just, assuming nothing goes wrong. There's also the crew to consider. They did not anticipate an extra 200 days flight time, plus however long we remain in the Aldebaran system itself."
"Rubbish. I know you space types. They will relish the opportunity of performing first contact."
"Then what about the ground forces on Thalspring? When will we return for them?"
"Captain, you will either give the order to go FTL or tell me you will not."
Sebastian Manet gave the obscured figure on the stretcher a hateful glance. "Very well. We will go FTL in another 8 minutes.
They had barely spoken in the 100 days that followed. Simon had spent a lot of the time asleep as the treatments ate into his reserves of strength. In his waking hours, he reviewed every scrap of data they'd acquired on the Arnoon alien, hoping for some insight. Each day, he checked the tracking data. Korobu remained a resolute 26 minutes and 13 seconds ahead of them. He began to make his own plans for exodus. Manet, along with his crew, could not be trusted with what needed to be done, and they couldn't be allowed to interfere. Simon's personal AS reviewed and confirmed all the command codes, ensuring he retained ultimate authority over the starship. 10 days before the exodus, Simon ordered the doctors to end his treatment. The interval would allow him to build his strength up again. On the day itself, he remained in sick bay. The doctors and medical staff had been dismissed. He lay on the bed content that the pain had reduced over the last 3 months. He would have the physical resources to carry this out. His DNI and optronic membrane linked him with every vital sensor outside the starship, their data formatted by his personal AS into a comprehensive wraparound display, putting his perception point at the front of the starship. At the moment, it was surrounded by a formless gray haze with an ebony knot far ahead of them. Indigo ranging data scrolled across it. Simon kept switching his attention between it and the other knot, the one following them 40 minutes behind. He knew the SK-9 had somehow got himself up to orbit and into a starship. There was only one reason he'd do that. "Shouldn't be long now," Captain Manet announced. "We're detecting the photosphere." Beyond the knot representing the Korobu, a faint drizzle of black was creeping through the nothingness, as if space were coming to an end outside the compression wormhole. Then the knot began to waver, expanding as it lost density. It vanished. "They left that late," Manet said. "Only 40 million kilometers out." "We need to be close to them," Simon said. "Yes, I know, but I'm going to shift our inclination. If they're really hostile, they'll mine the exodus zone." Simon spent the next 25 minutes watching the black barrier of the star's photosphere coming toward them, wondering what Newton and his friends were doing out there in real space. With 5 minutes to go until their own exodus, Manet armed the Norvell's missiles in preparation. The ship's AS primed the fusion drive under the bridge crew's supervision. Then the black wall was unnervingly close and beginning to pick up speed. It fractured radially with red streaks fizzling through. Then the huge starship was sailing high above a glaring carmine smog that seemed to stretch out forever in all directions. Columns of indigo digits streamed around Simon, mutating wildly as they went. There was no mass point within 500 kilometers. No sensor radiation fell across them. Infrared energy began to soak the fuselage. The big secondary chemical rocket engines around the cargo section flared brightly, initiating a slow thermal roll. Large rectangular radar antennae began to deploy. Simon used his command capability to launch a salvo of missiles. Pressure doors within the Norvell closed and locked, isolating the crew. "What are you doing?" Sebastian Manet demanded. "That's perfectly obvious, Captain. The Norvell is my ship, and I am carrying out my mission." He canceled the link and shut down all internal communications channels. On the bridge, Sebastian Manet stared on helplessly as his DNI was denied access to the starship's network. The console displays darkened. Two of the bridge officers hammered on the pressure door with their fist. Nobody heard them. "Sweet fate, they've fired their missiles," Lawrence said.
"Not at us," Denise assured him.
"What then?" "Oh!
Scatter pattern. I think they're going to try to strike the other ship at Exodus."
Lawrence opened the link to one. "Will you now accept that your knowledge shouldn't be given to this starship?" "The starship's actions support your contention so far. Our knowledge will be withheld pending resolution of this event."
"Thank you."
He turned to Denise. "Can we intercept those missiles?"
"No, we're too far away."
"Shit. Get Prime to scan for the Exodus. Use our main communication dish to broadcast a warning." Indigo targeting graphics locked onto a section of space 18,000 kilometers away as the Norvell's radar detected an object under acceleration. Simon's visual focus leaped across the distance. A long incandescent spark burned hard above the mellow radiance of the photosphere. It was moving fast, descending. Fusion flame, the starship's AS reported. Spectral pattern identical to our own. Radar substantiates vehicle size. It is the Korobu.
Where are they going? Simon asked. Several plot lines curved out of the dazzling plume. The Norvell's long-range radar began to sweep along them. It swiftly found the destination.
A solid structure, type unknown, the AS said. 20 kilometers across, circular, very regular.
Take us down to it, Simon ordered.
On the Clichanes Bridge, Simon Roderick sat behind the captain as they approached Exodus. Console panes counted down the last few seconds. Camera images turned to garish Carmen. A small cheer went round the bridge officers. Simon's D&I relayed the radar data directly to him. No large, solid objects within 500 kilometers. Several small points registered. Extraneous radar pulses were eliminating their fuselage. The AS confirmed their signature as the long-range type carried by both the Korobu and the Norvell. It began plotting their locations.
Receiving communications, the captain said. Somebody's shouting.
The AS showed a very powerful transmission beamed straight at them.
Your Exodus point is mined. Launch defense salvo.
Is that the Norvell? Simon asked.
There is no identification code, the AS told him.
Simon's personal AS checked the radar image again. The small points were now moving under heavy acceleration, tearing straight toward them. Clichane's AS immediately fired a counter salvo. The missiles slid out of their launch cradles around the cargo section. Solid rocket motors ignited, accelerating them at over 60 gravities. Sensors were degraded by the ion wind and radiation rising from the photosphere. The missiles' onboard programs tried to compensate, but the attacking missiles were also using countermeasures and impulses. The defenders responded with their own volley of electronic treachery. The Clichane's AS acknowledged that the defense salvo wouldn't be able to achieve precision elimination strikes. Attacking missiles would breach the defenses. It ordered separation, and the swarm blossomed as each missile discharged its multiple warheads. They were still inside safe distance limit, but the attacking missiles were closing. The AS had no choice. A huge corona of nuclear fire erupted around the Clichane as the barrage of defending warheads detonated. The spherical plasma shock waves clashed and merged, forming a hellish shield of seething raw energy. Secondary explosions ripped long ebony twisters through the rampaging ions, short-lived hypervelocity spikes that tried to assail the starship. At the center of the fusion inferno, the Clichane was buffeted by radiation. Its external sensors were blinded as hard X-rays burned up their circuitry. M-pulses induced huge power surges along electrical cables and metal structures. Temperature escalated, blackening the thermal protection foam before the surface began to ablate, shedding scabby charcoal flakes. The residual foam bubbled like molten tar. A hurricane of elementary particles washed across the besieged fuselage. In the bridge and throughout the life support wheels, radiation monitors began a shrill whistle of alarm. Emergency pressure valves began venting deuterium gas from tanks around the fusion drive section as the liquid started to boil from the electromagnetic energy input. Thermal radiator panels ruptured, jetting their sticky, steaming fluid into the hurricane of neutrons swirling around the giant starship. Simon clung to one of the consoles as the bridge shook. Loud, harsh, metallic creaking sounds reverberated through the life support wheel structure as the lights flickered. The radiation alarm kept up its insistent whistle. Schematics had turned completely red. The AS was battling to compensate for massive systems failure, rerouting power and data, isolating leaking tanks and fractured pipes. Backup thermal reservoirs were used to absorb the heat seeping through the fuselage structure. Over half of the secondary rockets were disabled.
The AS fired the remaining engines in short bursts, attempting to counter the twisting impulses from the larger vents. The whistle alarm slowly faded. One of the officers was throwing up. Simon had to force himself to let go of the console. His heartbeat was racing badly. "We weren't hit," the captain said incredulously. "How do you know?" Simon asked. "There was no external sensor data available at all." "We're still alive." The officers had begun talking urgently to the AS. Fingers skidded over the console keyboards as they tried to pull useful information from the degraded network. Reserve sensors deployed from their sheaths. The AS located the two radar sources again. They were both under acceleration. "How long before we can get after them?" Simon asked. "I should have an answer for you in about a week," the captain said. The Caribou's telescope immediately blanked out as the nuclear warheads exploded around the Cliché. Filter programs compensated as the fury slowly diminished. They saw the starship wreathed in coiling gas plumes. They were alive with scintillations from the radiation blitz, entombing the giant ship in a nebula of shooting stars. Venting had imparted a slow tumble. Lawrence didn't like to think how much liquid would have to be evacuated to move something so massive. Then they saw a flare of rocket motors around the cargo section as the AS attempted to stabilize their attitude. Lawrence realized he'd been holding his breath for a long time. "They're alive, then," he said. "Unless the Norvell fires at them again," Denise said. "With the state they're in, I doubt they'll be able to defend themselves." "Can you defend yourself against that kind of attack?" Lawrence asked one. "No," one replied. "There is no reason for us to be armed. We have nothing other than knowledge, and that we give." "Yeah, you live to share," Lawrence said. "What happens when other species do threaten you?" "We incorporate the knowledge of the threat." "That's it?" Denise asked. "That's all you do? Remember being destroyed?" "We exist to acquire and distribute knowledge. We hatch in every sector of the galaxy and examine what surrounds us. Once that has been accomplished and the sun cools again, our existence there ends. Another sun will eventually replace it. The overall processing of knowledge will continue no matter how many individuals of our species are exterminated. Very few other species have sufficient munitions to destroy every one of us. By now, our eggs have probably reached other galaxies." "Are you saying you don't care if you're destroyed?" "Care is an emotion I do not possess. You know it because it is bound with your sense of individuality. We are not a hive mind, but we are aware of ourselves as a civilization that could well prove to be eternal. All events we encounter contribute to what we are and what we will become. All individuality ends eventually. We birthed ourselves in acknowledgement of that." "But the person in command of the second starship could threaten to destroy you if he realizes how vulnerable you are." "If threatened, I will provide the knowledge required. The threat will end." "You said you'd withhold it," Lawrence said. "In the assumption that would provide a balance for your species, you claimed the third starship would deliver our knowledge to your entire race. That is no longer possible." "We're going to have to go to Earth," Denise said. "Carry the knowledge ourselves and get there ahead of the Norvell." "Damn Roderick to hell, I didn't want this." Lawrence held up a finger. "One, will you help repair the starship that has just been damaged?" "Yes. A pattern form can be provided that will modify itself to perform the operation." "So if we disable the Norvell, the balance will be restored. They can both be repaired simultaneously. There would be no monopoly when they return to Earth." "Will you make us a weapon that can disable the Norvell?" Denise asked quickly. "No," one said. "You may have knowledge that can be used to build a weapon."
"How long would it take to build?"
"First, you have to learn how to apply pattern form systems. Then you must integrate the knowledge for the weapon to be extruded."
"Yes, how long?"
"You have some familiarity with pattern form systems. This would be to your advantage. I estimate you would require as little as 3 weeks."
Frustration made Denise want to hit something, anything. The Caribou and the Norvell were equally matched.
If they launched a strike, the Norvell would retaliate. They needed something else, a weapon that would give them an advantage.
But you already have a weapon we can use, Lawrence said quietly.
The first thing the Norvell's sensors confirmed was the alien structure's complete lack of rotation in any direction. Somehow it held its attitude stable against the gusts of thick solar wind that blew constantly from the turbulent photosphere. Its shape gradually resolved during their approach, circular, divided into 20 scallop-like sections that curved down toward the surface of the star. Their edges were rounded and very smooth, tapering down to a few tenths of meters thick. Its bulk was concentrated in the middle, with a small aperture at the very center. Simon thought it might be a docking port of some kind, although he wasn't convinced. Even for an alien design, it was a very strange habitat. The apex of each scallop sprouted three slender ridges that shone a livid scarlet, radiating heat away out toward the stars, leaving the rest of the upper surface considerably cooler. The AS postulated that this was how the structure generated its power, exploiting the thermal difference. To do so, the ridges could well be a type of thermal superconductor. An interesting technology, Simon thought, but hardly on a level with nanonic systems. The Corbu's fusion burn ended, rendezvousing it with the alien structure. It hung inside the umbra, 3 kilometers from the surface. Simon waited, half expecting to see an engineering shuttle fly over into the aperture. "What are you doing?" he muttered to himself. Norvell's long-range radar continued to scan around. The AS detected another 11 similarly sized alien objects within 150,000 kilometers. If they were some alien version of habitats, it gave him a seriously large population base to deal with. There must be millions of similar structures in orbit around the red giant. "Have we intercepted any interstructure communications yet?" he asked the starship's AS. "Not in the electromagnetic spectrum. They could be using lasers or masers. In order to intercept them, we would have to insert ourselves into the beam." "Never mind." He continued to study the structure. When they were 2,000 kilometers away, Norvell extended its magnetometer booms. The alien structure was the core of a vast magnetic field. Around the center, it was as dense as a tokamak containment field. Vast, invisible flux wings extended for hundreds of kilometers below the star-facing surface. Simon altered the calibration of the main radar and refocused the telescope. The AS combined the data from each, presenting it as a false-color thematic image. Solar wind was being scooped up by the magnetic field and pulled inward. He could see tenuous eddies of the stuff forming as it streamed up toward the hidden center of the structure's star-facing surface. He knew it couldn't be a habitat. A machine of some kind, then. One that consumed solar wind particles. What sort of machine did that? He knew the aliens had nanonic systems. They must be converting the solar wind into artifacts of some kind. The production capacity represented by the millions of structures was awesome, although that would be severely limited by the minuscule quantity of mass that the magnetic field scooped up. If you had that kind of ability, why use it like this? That was when he recognized what the structures were. "Open a link to the Corbu," Simon ordered the AS. "Lawrence Newton, can you hear me?" "Loud and clear. Is this Simon Roderick?" "It is." "Your clone told us about you. I don't suppose he was very flattering." "He made some strong claims. Your attack on the Clichane would seem to validate them." "If you know about me, you know why I had to do that." "I know your rationale for the attack. That doesn't mean I agree with it." "I've seen your file, Newton. You gave up everything, a whole world, for the chance to fly explorer starships. You know there is more to the human condition than what we are today, and now we can realize that goal for everyone."
"Whether they want it or not."
"It is the underclass that prevented you from making those flights you dreamed of. They restricted you more than they ever did me."
"I'm not arguing with you. I'm telling you, I will not allow you to impose change on people. You and your clone may have the information together."
"Is it yours to give?"
"Yes.
I think not. This isn't a habitat, is it? Not some artifact. This is the alien itself. How utterly magnificent, a creature of pure space. Yes, this is the alien. One of them crashed on Arnoon, didn't it? That's what made the crater next to the village. Your research is very competent. It made no sense at first why an alien with nanonic technology would enlist human allies and steal a starship. It was damaged. It didn't have all of its abilities. And now we've brought it back to its own kind. What were you going to do with the technology, Newton? Nothing. I'm going home. I don't believe that either. You're from a bored family. You would use it to your advantage, just like me. Wrong. I suggest you go back to the Cliché and help its crew. Once you've done that, the technology will be made available. Have you really convinced the aliens to cooperate with you already? Or are you hiding something from me? Why don't you go back and help the Cliché? This ship is in no condition to help anybody. We barely made it here. But how were you planning to get home? Can the alien nanonics repair your ship? I suppose they can. They can. How interesting. In that case, I think I will remain with you and observe them in action. It was an almost perfect solution, he realized. If he parked the Norvell in the alien's umbra, his proximity to the Korobu would provide him with the greatest possible opportunity to obtain a physical sample of the nanonic technology. He began to wonder just how much of an ally the alien was to Newton. How would it react to any attempted interdiction of nanonic systems? Certainly there had been no repercussions from his attack on the Cliché. Before he took such an overt course of action, he must at least try to establish communications with the alien. It could be that Newton was actually bluffing. The Norvell's fusion drive matched velocity with the vast alien, then slowly eased the starship into the umbra. It cut off, and the AS began firing the chemical rockets to refine their attitude. At that moment, they were 5 kilometers from the surface of the alien and 12 kilometers from the Korobu. Neither Newton nor the alien had responded to Simon's repetitive calls. The Norvell's magnetometer booms were still observing the titanic flux lines warping around the alien. Their pattern began to change, contracting like petals at sunset. But fast. What? Simon managed to ask. Lawrence had gone over the life cycle of the dragons many times during the 100-day voyage. Naturally, the creatures fascinated him. Then actually seeing them through the starship's sensors thrilled him even more. He loved their elegance. He even admired their philosophy, despite how frustrating it was to his situation. Each dragon must have taken centuries to grow to its full size. Like Simon Roderick, he watched the magnetic field gather up wisps of solar wind, ingesting them for the active pattern form system to alchemize, a slow, laborious process given the quantity involved. Some of the molecules were used to replenish and sustain the dragon's own body, but once it had reached its full size, most were given to the production of eggs. Each one took a long time to convene. Not only did its physical structure have to be put together a particle at a time, but those particles had to be loaded with data from the ever-shifting tides of knowledge possessed by the Dragon Star civilizations. Once an egg was complete, it would be sent off into interstellar space, to fall aimlessly through the galaxy. But the dragons were in orbit around Aldebaran, tied to the star by gravity. The eggs couldn't just be detached from the adult. They would simply drift around the same orbit. So the center of every dragon was a magnetic cannon capable of accelerating an egg up to solar escape velocity. The Norvell was parked 5 kilometers from the muzzle when one fired. The egg, a solid sphere of matter 72 meters in diameter, struck the starship's complex and delicate compression drive section at over 40 kilometers per second. Chapter 19. Every bed in the Cliché's sickbay was occupied, mostly with victims of radiation burns sustained during the attack. Surrounding cabins had been converted to hold the overspill. The doctors walked around, checking vital signs, making sure their patients were comfortable. They didn't have a lot else to do.
Prime, improved with genuine dragon routines, was orchestrating the pattern form systems that had twined themselves through the flesh of each patient. This was a much more active application than the Arnoon dragon had ever achieved. The pattern form had grown with what resembled a network of veins over each man's skin. Tubules infiltrated the body, multiplying around the organs and muscles inside. Particles roamed through the damaged tissue, repairing cells and resequencing DNA smashed apart by the X-ray barrage. The computing power required to control the operation in each person was phenomenal. Pattern form had grown the processing nodules as well. They hung under each bed like leaf-green wasp nests, their root tendrils connecting them to the parallel vein network. Lawrence looked through a couple of the doors as he and Denise walked through the section. The men were all sleeping. "They look peaceful," he said.
"So did you," she told him.
The converted cabins were split with the Norvell crew members who had received more physical injuries when the dragon's egg struck. Their starship's axis had snapped from the egg impact, with two of the life support wheels being flung off into space as the broken sections tumbled away from one. Over 100 crew had ejected in lifeboats. Those remaining in the two intact wheels had waited for the Korobu to rendezvous, then transferred over for the short journey to the Clichane. Now the two remaining starships were parked in one's umbra as pattern form strands began to creep across them. Simon Roderick was waiting for Lawrence and Denise outside a cabin with a closed hatch. The locks disengaged, and he pushed it open. They followed him in. There was a single bed inside. The SK-2 lay on it, also encased in pattern form systems. His legs and hand were being grown back. A skin sustainer cabinet that had been brought into the cabin was smothered in a lacework of pattern form veins. They were harvesting the organic components and blood reserves for raw material to generate new tissue. Flaccid translucent sacs, the shape of legs already extended from his stumps, with glutinous fluids circulating inside. Denise's expression tightened as she looked down at the unconscious man.
"What do you intend to do with him?"
"For the immediate future, he will be excluded from the board, and most of his executive privileges will be revoked. House arrest, essentially. After that, who knows? I suspect it depends on what form Earth's society chooses to follow."
"Good enough," Lawrence said. He ignored the dirty look Denise threw him.
"None of us exactly came out of this as saints."
"No," Simon agreed. "But then I never claimed to be."
"How would your clone siblings react to all this?"
"The same as we did. Not that it will really matter." He gave both of them a pointed look.
"The captains will make sure the dragon knowledge is given to everyone when we return. They're already making plans to transfer the memories directly into Earth's data pool before ZB even notices there's something different about their old starship. It'll be protected by this upgraded prime, which should ensure equal access."
"You sound as though you disapprove."
"I almost do," Simon gestured at his clone sibling. "We're a chaotic race. His method would have given us a smooth transition."
"Where's the fun in that?" Lawrence said. "Tear down the uniculture, open your eyes, give people their identity back."
"Ah." Simon's eyebrows arched in modest censure. "I might have guessed."
"How long before the Clichane is flightworthy?" Denise asked.
"Another fortnight," Simon said. "Quite remarkable, really. Fortunately, there's plenty of spare mass to restructure missing components. After all, we hardly need the weapons or all that asset cargo now.
Are you sure you don't want to come back with us?
It'll be an interesting time to live in."
"No," Denise said curtly. Lawrence just smiled.
The Clichane's compression drive powered up, and the immense starship flashed out of space-time with a dizzying twist. The Korobu was left floating alone in the dragon's umbra. It was never going to fly again. Instead, it was giving birth. Pattern form had planted the fuselage in a gridiron of crystalline stems that suckled at the minerals and compounds of the structure. From a distance, it looked as though the starship was covered in a harlequin patchwork of gem frost. Millions of slender amber, ruby, and emerald facets flashed and glinted in the haze of warm light
that spilled around the edge of the alien. Wider sapphire proboscises had penetrated tanks, siphoning out the liquids to contribute to the semi-organic growths sprouting on opposite sides of the cargo section. As the weeks progressed, they swelled out into chrysalids, wrapped in a tight skin of diamond strand silk. The Arnoon dragon, too, was metamorphosing. The Shianti's payload bay doors had been opened to space. Inside the bay, the cargo pod had split apart, exposing the dragon. Crystals threaded their way across the floor of the maintenance bay and encrusted the space plane. Their tips meshed with the particle structure of the dragon and began feeding it molecules and information. Denise spent hours every day thinking with it. As there was no place for it within the Aldebaran dragon civilization, it had decided to go with her to become a part of whatever society flowered from the genetic package. Dragon memories were reviewed and analyzed for templates of the abilities they sought. They began to incorporate functions that would allow it to be free-flying, to sense in every spectrum, to power itself with sunlight, to absorb solid cold matter, to retain its original personality. Dozens of notions taking on solid form. After the Clichane left, Lawrence spent 10 days undergoing extensive pattern form treatment, transforming his body and resetting his DNA. He emerged as his teenage self, without skin valves. Denise looked him up and down and pursed her lips. "Very cute," she observed coyly. The chrysalid cases split open and peeled back, revealing the Ring Empire-era starships that pattern form had gestated, streamlined silver and magenta ellipsoids, with a necklace of drive fins and forward-swept power shields rising smoothly from the rear quarter. Lawrence gazed at his with reckless enthusiasm that matched his new adolescence. "I guess this is goodbye," Denise said. He gave her an awkward grimace.
"Yeah."
Then his smile returned. "No, it's bon voyage. The way things are shaping up, it's not impossible that we'll meet again." "All right, Lawrence. Bon voyage it is." She gave him a soft kiss. "What are you going to name yours?"
"That's easy. Fool's Errand."
Denise laughed. "Mine's the Starflower."
"Sounds good."
The interior of the Fool's Errand comprised three circular lounges with concave walls. In their neutral state, the cream-colored surfaces had the same texture as soft leather. Human-styled fittings could distend out of it as required. The lounges also made perfect auditoriums, capable of providing a 360-degree image that could show either sensor images or any of the eyes that he'd loaded from the Korobu's multimedia library. Lawrence walked into the forward lounge, enjoying the novelty of a standard gravity field. A single luxurious chair rose up out of the center of the floor. He settled himself in it and called up a visual sensor image. The front of the lounge melted away, showing him the Korobu's crystal gilded fuselage dead ahead. In his mind, a broad crown of the starship's system icons burned a willing gold. He selected several, and the Fool's Errand slowly backed out of the inert chrysalis. An idiot's grin spread over his face as the ship's elegance and power became apparent, and he alone commanded it. The Starflower rose into view from the other side of the Korobu. He watched as Denise flew around to the drastically mutated maintenance bay. The Arnoon dragon waited at the center. Elegant semi-organic segments closed against the main body, solar wing sheets furled tight. Watching the Starflower touch it was like seeing two drops of water merging. The dragon was absorbed through the shimmering hull, leaving only a slight bulge to betray its presence. Then the Starflower moved out into clear space beyond One's Umbra. Lawrence could see the strange forces gathering around the drive section as the power shields and fins shone like fragments of a blue-white star. It flung itself into the null void.
"Thank you for your help," Lawrence told One. "We will learn what you become," the dragon replied, "and we will remember you. This is what we are."
Lawrence selected his course, delving deep into some of the oldest memories the dragons possessed for the information. The engines gathered up their colossal strength and impelled the Fool's Errand
into the null void. Nebulas are among the most beautiful objects in the sky, revered by astronomers across the galaxy. Fluoresced by stars hidden deep inside, they shade parsecs with the most magical patterns of shifting primordial light. Yet for all their grandeur, they are transient. The stars that provide their ethereal beauty also blow out a hard wind of ions that slowly disperses the gas and dust. Gravity, too, plays its part, inexorably thinning out the streamers and clouds. Protostars perform the opposite function, their great glowing whorls sucking in the spectral tides, compressing them down to a central spark. Their lifetimes are measured in millions of years only, negligible in galactic time scales. Even the Ulidan Nebula, one of the thickest and darkest ever to form in the galaxy, was waning when the Ring Empire archaeologists came across the planet of the Mordiff. By the time of the Decadence War, it was just a zone of interstellar space with a slightly higher than average gas density. Even then, the Mordiff sun was cold and shrunken, no more than a glimmering red ember, just a memory within the newborn dragon civilizations. It took Lawrence Newton and the Fool's Errand a long time to find the cool star husk with its single lonely planet. But eventually the beautiful starship fell from the sky and landed beside the one remaining relic of the Mordiff. Lawrence put on a spacesuit and stepped down onto the planet's surface. There was no air left. It had bled away millions of years ago. The sand under his boots had frozen to a crust harder than iron, but there was still light. High above the horizon, the galactic core formed a lambent white swirl that occupied nearly a tenth of the sky. It cast a sharp shadow behind him as he walked. This was a landscape bleaker than any he had ever known. Rock outcrops were sharp and fractured. Even the stones that littered the ground were jagged. Over millions of years, cold had drawn the very color from the land. He knew this planet had no future left. That knowledge didn't bother him. He had come for its past. He paused on a low ridge and looked up at the terminus. It was strange, he thought, that a race so warlike and terrible could build a machine so much greater than themselves. The terminus was a broad toroid, snow-white in color, its inner aperture measuring 3 kilometers in diameter. 5 giant buttress towers supported it, 1 kilometer off the ground. Outcrops of rock rested against the base of each one, as if they were waves breaking against a cliff. Neither cold nor entropy had affected the titanic artifact. Even geology had been defeated by it. The Ring Empire archaeologists weren't even sure it was made from matter in the normal sense. Nothing else of the Mordiff remained. No ruins, no monuments. Only the terminus, their failed bid for immortality. Harsh turquoise light shone down out of the center, illuminating the frozen sand underneath. Lawrence was vaguely disappointed he couldn't actually see the wormhole, but the blue light acted like a veil across the aperture. After a while, Lawrence walked back to the Fool's Errand. He sat on his seat in the forward lounge and guided the starship under the toroid. It rose slowly into the blue haze. For a second, the sensors could see nothing. Then they were inside the wormhole. A tube of pale violet light stretched away from the starship. Ahead lay the future, billions of years stretching out to the end of the galaxy, when even the terminus fell into the black hole. In the other direction lay the past. Fool's Errand flew back into history. The three sister planets were moving into their major conjunction. It was a spectacular sight as the bright crescents lined up above the gentle rolling hills of New Arnoon. Denise was sitting in the shade of a big Cygni tree as they slid together, its ginger leaves casting a broad dapple over the grass around her. The cluster of 7-year-olds sitting on the ground sighed and cooed at the astral exhibition. If they squinted really hard, they could just make out hair-thin lines cutting across the distant planets. The silver threads of the world web spun out by the dragon in geostationary orbit were becoming more complex as the englobing progressed. Soon the whole world would be caged. These were exciting times for the children. "Finish it," Jones Johnson whined plaintively. "Please, Denise." But not as exciting as other people used to have, she thought in amusement. Little Jones was getting agitated, his face screwed up with urgency. "Finish! Finish!" the rest of them chanted. "All right," she said. Lawrence Newton tried not to show any nerves as he presented his ticket to the departures desk in the center of the terminal building. Templeton Spaceport was a small affair to the north of the domed city, a couple of runways and five hangars. It was built with arrivals in mind, 20,000 at a time, when one of MacArthur's starships decelerated into orbit. Traffic in the other direction was small and open to scrutiny. The receptionist scanned his ticket in and smiled as her sheet screen scrolled confirmation. "Do you have any baggage?" she asked. "One," Lawrence said. He was so relieved the Prime had guarded him from his father's askings, he made a hash of lifting the case onto her scales. She leaned over and helped him. "Why are you going?" she asked. "My family is sending me to university on Earth," he stammered. "Lucky you," she said brightly. "You can go through to the lounge now, Mr. Newton. Your flight leaves in 40 minutes, if the snowplows can keep the runway clear." "Thanks." His stomach felt curiously light. "Starflight. I'm going to have a starflight, I really am." And that made up for absolutely everything. He straightened his back and walked toward the lounge door. Out of the corner of his eye, he could see Vinnie Carlton hanging around by the main entrance. Lawrence gave him a surreptitious thumbs up. Vinnie winked back. The lounge doors closed behind him. Ahead of him, the picture window gave him a view out over the long arrowhead-shaped space plane that was due to take him up to the Eilean. Lawrence hurried forward for a better look. Vinnie Carlton watched the lounge doors shut. He went out to the taxi rank and climbed into the first of the little white bubbles. "Leith Dome," he told the vehicle's AS. A thin hail of ice twisted around them on the road. Vinnie settled back in the seat, closed his eyes, and concentrated. The flesh on his face rippled. Characteristics began to shift, his nose flattening slightly, chin protruding, eyebrows straightening. He opened his eyes, now shaded halfway between gray and green. When he looked in the taxi's mirror to check, Lawrence Newton's young features looked back at him. It had been so many months he barely recognized himself. Sadly, he acknowledged that for all the perfect physical regeneration pattern form had given him, he could never project the naivete that his younger self had always possessed. An inevitable consequence, he thought, not just from the 20 years of experience he owned, but also the result of living beside his earlier self for so long. That proximity had been so much harder than he'd ever imagined. There had been so many times when, as Vinnie, he'd wanted to give that love-stricken, horrifyingly ignorant teenage Lawrence a damn good kicking. But he hadn't. For all those months, he'd been a good friend on every level, gritting his teeth as he watched the doomed love affair play out from a vantage point that was far too close. Time and again, when they'd been out in a group, he'd seen the fear hidden in Rosalind's eyes when Lawrence was looking the other way. She must have known he'd find out eventually. Still, she carried on, just as besotted and tragic as that desperate teenage boy, clinging to her fragile happiness. He'd lost count of the times he'd almost surrendered to his stormy emotions and whispered to her, "It'll be all right." Ultimately, he didn't have that right, for he didn't truly know yet if it would be. The features on the fresh young face in the taxi's mirror had sunk into a drawn, nervous expression as the weight of 20 years and 2 broken lives emerged as part of its genuine identity. "Now you've really come home," he said to it. The elevator took an age to get up to the right floor. Lawrence remembered the anxiety he'd felt as he left Amathai for Earth. This was worse. He took the memory chip from his pocket and studied it curiously. The very last episode of Flight Horizon, and he still hadn't accessed the damn thing. It just wouldn't have been right by himself. He flipped it like a coin and tucked it away again, smiling to himself. The elevator doors opened and his smile faded. His legs were very unsteady as he walked down the corridor. He stood outside the apartment door, too scared to move. "I've invaded planets.
I've been charged by a herd of macro-rexes. I've seen dragons in their natural habitat. I've walked on the planet of the Mortif. Now knock, you coward. His fingers rapped lightly on the door. Rosalind opened it. She'd been crying. I'm an idiot, Lawrence had blurted. But I had a lot of time to think. A lot of time. And the one thing I want to do more than anything else in the universe is to tell you that I love you. Several of the children had clasped their hands together as they gazed up at Denise. All of them had fallen silent. They were smiling contentedly. Denise had about 5 seconds of peace while the story sank in. But what did she say to him? Did they get married? Will they live happily ever after? She held up her hands in a plea for quiet. I don't know exactly what happened next, not there or on Earth, but I'm sure Lawrence and Rosalind must have spent a long and happy time together. At least... What? Jones demanded, eyes bugging. It's just that Lawrence never wanted to get involved, but simply knowing makes you involved. That's what the dragons taught us. Knowledge is the only true immortal. And he knew that in 20 years' time, the Clichane was going to arrive back on Earth with pattern form and the dragon's memories. The human race would change. So there he was on the planet that was his true home with the girl he loved. And he had the fool's errand with him. He had the knowledge to turn Amathai into a paradise and populate it with angels long before Earth had the ability. Poor, dear old Lawrence. I wonder if he could resist the temptation. End of Fallen Dragon by Peter F. Hamilton.